Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Today we continue our special series, as many of our stations are in their fundraising efforts, on the history of the United States, a series which we dive into our vast archives over the years, and each day bring you a program that we hope illuminates the narrative arc of this country's history. Yesterday we began with Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on settler colonialism. Today we turn to the beginnings of the United States and the creation of the U.S. Constitution, a document that still governs this country today. For this, we present our conversation with Michael Clareman, professor at Harvard Law School and author of the book, The Framers' Coup, The Making of the United States Constitution.
Michael Clareman, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to our radio program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Tell me about Shay's Rebellion.
Right. Starts the previous summer of 1786. Massachusetts has, for lack of a better word, one of the more conservative constitutions among the states, meaning that it's somewhat less responsive to populist opinion than other state legislatures, other state constitutions such as Pennsylvania. What that means is the Massachusetts legislature, somewhat disregarding the sentiments of debtor farmers, has decided that it's actually going to raise taxes in 1786. It's trying to pay off its requisitions to Congress. Congress doesn't really have a taxing power, but it issues requests for money. And most of the
states
were
not paying. That's what requisitions are, right? I was trying to even figure it out when I was going through the book. Requisitions are what you owe the federal government, what the states owe.
What the states owe, right. We would today call it taxes, but there was no compulsory mechanism. So they were basically voluntary requests, meaning the states wouldn't always pay. Massachusetts was actually trying in good faith to raise revenue to pay its congressional requisitions, but farmers were having a very hard time, and in the midst of a severe economic contraction, it's not clear that you really want to be raising taxes. Because Congress required that the taxes be paid in gold and silver, that means farmers are going to have to cough up any gold and silver, and it turns out there isn't very much of that in circulation. So even if they wanted to pay their taxes, it's not clear that they've got the currency to do it. They do have monetizable wealth in their farms, but what they need to be able to do is borrow money on that and maybe get a little bit of tax relief. And they need some inflation of the currency so that they can pay from paper money, which is essentially a loan that the government would be offering them. So in the absence of that sort of relief, which most state legislatures provided, but the Massachusetts legislature didn't provide, there's an uprising, and a couple thousand farmers, led by a Revolutionary War veteran, Daniel Shays, decided that they would prefer to shut down the civil courts than be bankrupted. And the Eastern creditor elite ends up hiring an army, basically a private army, to suppress the insurrection. And this had a pretty dramatic effect, as you might expect, on the New England more aristocratic elite types. They saw the sky was falling, that basically people were taking the law into their own hands and shutting down the civil courts in order to avoid paying their debts and taxes. And this made a lot of them much more sympathetic to the idea of a powerful national government that was more removed from the will of the people, and that if necessary could supply federal troops to suppress debtor insurrections.
My impression was, with Shay's Rebellion, and what ended up happening actually first to the rebellion?
It was put down with some bloodshed, not an enormous amount from a modern perspective. A few people were killed. It was put down by that army established by Eastern creditors, but it had a huge effect on the willingness of various states to send delegates to this Philadelphia convention that had been called for May to write a constitution. It probably had an effect on George Washington's willingness to attend the convention, and it clearly had an effect on the New England elite, who previously had been pretty skeptical about the idea of a national convention, which they had been concerned might be dominated by Southerners, and they were concerned would turn the country in an anti-Republican direction, and they became more sympathetic to that idea. Washington's correspondence talks about how the New England elite was increasingly starting to look fondly on the idea of a king if it was necessary to have an anti-Republican government in order to make sure that the rule of law was implemented and that you didn't have too much populist influence on government. They were starting to think, well, maybe that's what we need to do.
You said the Shays Rebellion was put down by, a militia that was put together by Eastern creditors?
Yeah, it's a private army, basically. These are the people who held the debt. They were the creditors, so they had a very direct interest in making sure that those debts were paid and that the courts weren't shut down. And they were the ones who coughed up the money to hire the militia. I think part of the problem was that militia are just ordinary people, and they might decline to intervene against Shays' army, which was also consisting of ordinary people who were not really trying to overthrow the government. They were just trying to protect their farms from being taken from them in bankruptcy. It's not hard to be sympathetic to them. They felt like, it really wasn't fair that they were being taxed at fairly high rates and desperate economic conditions. And the money that they were being taxed for was going to creditors who had often been speculators who had just bought up the debt for pennies on a dollar. They'd often bought the debt from the very same people who were now joining Shays' army, right? So you suppose you're a Revolutionary War soldier and you got paid not in cash, but you got paid in scrip. You got paid in some sort of government IOU. And then in desperate times, you would sell that to a speculator because it wasn't clear that the federal government would ever be able to redeem it in actual currency. So you might sell it to a Boston creditor for 10 cents on the dollar. Those people scooped up the debt, and now they're demanding pretty rigorous implementation of taxes to pay off the debt. And that didn't necessarily seem fair to the farmers. So they decided they were going to do something about it. They're going to take the law into their own hands. And then the Eastern creditors couldn't necessarily trust the government militia because the government militia is just composed of ordinary people who might decide that they weren't going to fire upon their comrades. And so they hired their own private army, basically.
That's interesting. So the economic condition in the 13 states making up the United States is just after the Revolutionary War is a dire one because the country's in major debt in large part because of the war debt that it owes. And so this is a situation in Massachusetts. You mentioned Massachusetts. I think you said was maybe more conservative or at least not as easy on requiring its citizens to pay taxes because other states are taking different measures than Massachusetts, so they don't have the same situation that Massachusetts had.
A majority of the states, at least 7 of the 13 states, have passed paper money laws, which are basically you're emitting paper money, which is basically just loaning money to farmers. So they're paying interest on it, but it enables them to monetize the wealth they have in the farm and to pay their taxes. So a majority of states have passed paper money laws and debt relief laws. So a debt relief law, for example, might say, even though you have a contract with a creditor and you have to pay back a certain sum on a certain day, we're going to give you 6 extra months to pay the debt, or we'll allow you to pay the debt not in hard currency, even though that's what the contract calls for. We'll allow you to pay it in some other sort of in-kind property. And a majority of states are passing those laws because most of the state constitutions are very democratic, and these debtor farmers are a majority of the population. So when they demand relief, they tend to get it. In the state that they didn't get it, in Massachusetts, basically things they build up until finally some steam is let off and the farmers decide to shut down the courts. But in most of the states, there have been smaller variations on Shays' Rebellion. So in Massachusetts, you've got a larger larger revolt. But in other states, especially in western parts of the states, it wasn't unusual to have similar sorts of efforts, but on a smaller scale, if the legislature was not perceived as being sufficiently responsive to demands for debt and tax relief, then people would shut down the courts rather than see their farms taken away from them.
And it's your argument that this situation with these rebellions Shays rebellions, other rebellions that are happening throughout the country, and then states responding to the popular will of their citizens at the time is what that would bring alarm to, I guess, who we call the leaders of the country for bringing a constitutional convention?
I don't want to reduce it to one variable, and I don't want to claim any great originality for the argument. This argument's been around for 100 years. I basically agree with it, and I've tried to flesh it out, perhaps in a little bit more detail. And I've also tried to offer an explanation of how the elite was able to pull off this kind of coup, which is adopting a more conservative constitution to suppress the debt and tax relief movement. But there's clearly more than one thing going on. The Articles of Confederation, which are what was kind of the governing arrangement before the Constitution, it's clearly failing because the national government just doesn't have sufficient power. As we've already discussed, it doesn't have a taxing power. It doesn't have power to regulate foreign or international commerce. It doesn't even have the power to implement the treaties, which it's explicitly given authority to negotiate, but there's no mechanism for obliging a state to comply with a treaty that the national government has negotiated. So clearly something has to be done about this. The national government just needs to be made more powerful. But there's another dimension, which is the anti-populist aspect of the Constitution. You could make a more nationally powerful government without making it as anti-populist as the framers did. So those are two different dimensions to think about. One is shifting power from the state and local level to the national level, and the other is trying to remove the national government to the extent possible from direct control of the people using mechanisms like lengthy terms in office, indirect elections. A lot of the disagreement among historians is which of these should we see as the dominant dimension. And I think maybe the kind of conventional view is this is to emphasize the nationalizing dimension, that what we're doing is responding to acknowledged deficiencies in the national government by making it more powerful. And I think I'm suggesting, and other revisionists have suggested, that that's downplaying the anti-populist angle too much. And Madison actually said at the convention that of the things that brought them to Philadelphia, he thought the most important factor was this need to respond to the excessively populist impulses that had been predominating in the state. So Madison's a pretty good adjudicator of this disagreement among historians. He's really more responsible than anyone else for the success of the movement for the Constitution. And he said pretty explicitly in Philadelphia, you know, to the extent we're here for one predominant reason, it's to try to suppress this excessively populist dimension of what's going on in the states.
And I do want to dive into how that happened within the Constitution itself. A little more on the Articles of Confederation and understanding what the United States was like during when it was governed by the Articles of the Confederation before we get the United States Constitution. Is it something to akin as the European Union or the United Nations, in which what you really had at the time were almost like 13 independent countries, even if they didn't see themselves as countries? Yeah.
Yeah, and they're even less integrated than the European Union is today, because the large part of the European Union is to create, I mean, the primary goal is to create a economic common union, and the Articles of Confederation were not that. So states could set up tariff barriers to one another. Congress had no authority to regulate interstate trade. States could discriminate against ships coming from other states, just as they could discriminate against ships coming from other nations. Basically, the Articles of Confederation were an effort to negotiate a pact among 13 independent states that were fighting a war for their independence. So what it mostly consists of is granting authority to a Congress to fight the Revolutionary War. So Congress has the power to negotiate a treaty like the treaty with France, which is what enabled the United States to be successful in the war. Congress can create a commander-in-chief, George Washington. Congress can request the states to contribute money that'll be used to pay off war expenses. But because the states were still very much jealous of their sovereignty, in the same way that we're seeing today, like with Brexit, with Britain leaving the European Union, states were very jealous of their sovereignty. They did not delegate a great deal of power. And so they didn't give Congress the authority to impose mandatory taxes. They didn't give Congress the authority to regulate interstate or international commerce. And they didn't create federal courts so that, you know, even if a Congress did have the authority, for example, to negotiate treaties, but if a state decides to violate the terms of the treaty, there are no federal courts in which you can haul the state in and try to force it to comply with the terms. So the Articles were a very weak alliance of 13 independent states that are joining together to fight for their independence, but don't necessarily see themselves as part of the same nation. I mean, you know, it's been pointed out, you know, Massachusetts had more in common with Great Britain than it had with South Carolina, and the same thing would be true for South Carolina. It has much closer relationships with London than it has with Boston. So, and most people spent their entire lives within 10 miles of where they grew up. So, you know, the idea of the United States today, where everybody moves around, you go to college in a different place, you get a job in a different place, that wasn't really descriptive of their experience back then. They were very jealous of the idea of conferring power to a national entity.
This is Letters in Politics, and we are in conversation with Michael J. Clareman. He is the Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, author of the book, The Framers' Coup, The Making of the United States Constitution, and that is what we are in conversation about. So let's get into the Constitutional Convention of 1787. It's happening in Philadelphia. It would go from, I think, May 25th to September 17th. And just from what you just said there about the Articles of Confederation, it isn't really what's behind the great debate. And there was never any certainty that this Constitution was going to even make it out of the convention, never mind be ratified by a sufficient number of states. But it sounds to me that what's really behind this debate, if we're talking about these 13 original states or basically their own independent countries, it almost sounds like they were negotiating or they were debating whether or not they should give up their own sovereignty.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the question, one of the main questions in Philadelphia is how much of their sovereignty they're willing to give up. And they are willing to give up more of it than they had been under the Articles of Confederation. One of the interesting questions to me as I'm working on the book is the convention seems to be of a greater nationalist bent and a greater anti-populist bent than the American citizenry as a whole. So I'm trying to figure out why the convention was not perfectly representative of the country, why it's willing to go further in granting power to the national government than the average American citizen would have been, and then how they managed to convince the country to ratify this thing that is both more nationalizing and more anti-populist or anti-democratic than the average American was inclined to support. You're exactly right. It's highly uncertain, highly contingent. The Philadelphia Convention almost fell apart. The ratification struggle almost was unsuccessful. At the end of the day, they barely succeeded in accomplishing what I call a kind of coup against public opinion, because it's pretty clear they did go further in a nationalizing direction and in an anti-populist direction than most Americans were comfortable with. You know, just one example, there were several people, not a majority, not even close to a majority, but there were several delegates in Philadelphia who would have been happy to obliterate the states entirely and just create a nation without even a federal system at all, just basically destroy the existing states and just create one conglomerated nation. And there were very few people in the country who would have supported that, but there were several delegates in Philadelphia, like George Reed of Delaware, Alexander Hamilton of New York, who were prepared to go that far. So it's an interesting puzzle. Why does the convention disproportionately consist of people who are inclined to go pretty far in that direction relative to the country as a whole? And I try to offer some explanations for why that would happen.
So how did it get to be so underrepresentative of the populist feels or the populist sentiments of the day at the convention?
So it, I offered a bunch of different explanations, which are conjectural, but I hope together might, you know, offer a plausible explanation. One thing is simply that the states generally chose their most eminent citizens to go to Philadelphia, and by virtue of being the most eminent citizen in a state like Virginia or South Carolina, that usually meant you were a large landowner, that you had participated in the Revolutionary War as a soldier, that you'd served in the Continental Congress. And those were experiences that were fairly nationalizing, right? For example, George Washington, as commander-in-chief of the Revolutionary Army, became a nationalist for life, partly because he had been struggling to create a nation, but also partly because he greatly resented the extent to which the states had been impediments to success during the Revolutionary War, because the states had refused to pony up money and the states had refused to provide soldiers when the Revolutionary Army was desperately in need. So one factor is just how are these people chosen? And simply by virtue of being the most eminent citizens in the country, they were disproportionately likely to be nationalist and anti-populist. Another explanation is the people who chose to go and the people who chose not to go. There were some people who were appointed as delegates, like Patrick Henry of Virginia, who chose not to go to Philadelphia for reasons that are not entirely clear. And he turned out to be one of the great critics of the Constitution. If people, about 8 or 10 of those delegates like that, had chosen to turn down their appointments and then had become leading critics of the document that came out of the convention, if they had chosen to go and fight for something that was more satisfying toward their views, less nationalist, less anti-populist, then maybe the Constitution wouldn't have leaned that far in that direction. Some people also went to Philadelphia, and when they didn't like the way the convention was trending, they decided to leave, and thereby ensuring that the convention would go even further in the direction that they disapproved of. They were hoping that they could delegitimize the convention by walking out, but instead, they ensured that the convention would adopt an even more nationalist and anti-populist document. There are a couple other factors. You know, they closed the doors of the convention, which meant that they didn't have newspaper reporters in the galleries writing down what they were saying and publicizing it to the nation. And I think that liberated the delegates to take more extreme positions than they otherwise might have done, because it would have jeopardized their political careers to take positions like the one that Hamilton expressed privately at the convention, that the state should simply be abolished. So, and finally, the delegates just decided to go for broke. They decided they were going to take a chance and see what they could get away with. They thought this might be the last genuine opportunity they would have to reform the governing document in as radical a way as they preferred. And they decided to go for broke, and they ended up being successful, although, as I said, it was a narrowly fought contest, and they just barely emerged victorious.
Yeah. Staying with this vein here, let's talk about the formation and what the Constitution actually does of itself. And when you talk about who came and who was chosen and who decided to stay home and all that, about who ended up participating in the Constitutional Convention itself and how it may not truly have represented the interest of everyday people, Congress itself was designed to have that a similar dynamic to it, didn't it?
Right. So there are a lot of different examples of the things that they did that might not have been so popular in the country. But one is they give Congress very broad power, and they structure Congress in a way that it will be much more removed from the ordinary citizen's political influence than a state legislature of that day would have been. So two different dimensions. One is empowering Congress in ways that were different from the Articles of Confederation, and structuring Congress in a way that would enable greater distance, both physical and metaphorical, between constituents and their representatives. So a couple examples of the power. Congress is given almost unlimited taxing power, whereas under the Articles, all it had was this power of requisition to make requests. Congress is given almost unlimited military powers, raising an army, creating a navy, calling state militias into federal service. Congress is given unlimited power to regulate foreign and interstate commerce. Congress is explicitly granted implied powers. So in addition to each of the enumerated powers like the taxing power, the power to regulate commerce, Congress is also given the power to pass any laws necessary and proper to implementing the enumerated powers, which is essentially a grant of implied powers. So those are all a significant broadening of Congress's powers relative to the articles. But then they also created a Congress that was very distant from the people, so much longer terms in office. Senators served 6 years, representatives served 2 years. Under state constitutions, almost all office holders had to be annually elected. Indirect election of senators, indirect election of presidents, very large constituencies. So Congress was going to be tiny. The first Congress was 65 representatives for the entire nation. That's compared to the Massachusetts lower house, which had over 300 representatives. That's a very large constituency for each congressional representative. And the point of that was both to ensure that the quote-unquote better sort, you know, the very well-known large farmers, the wealthy elite would be elected to office, but also to create more distance between representatives and constituents to ensure that the national government would not never fall under the populist thumb of the citizenry. So on both dimensions, the Constitution is actually a pretty radical departure from the status quo, and they actually wanted to go further. It's an important point to note that they were constrained by the need to get what they did ratified by popular conventions, so they didn't go as far as they were inclined to. Many of the delegates in Philadelphia would have liked to create a lifetime tenured president, and many of them would have liked to create longer terms in office than 6 years for senators. So they talked about 9-year terms, 13-year terms, 15-year terms, kind of unimaginable from a modern perspective, but they were trying to create an institution in the Senate that was like the British House of Lords, and they were trying to create an institution in the presidency that was much further in the direction of a monarch than any of the state governors at the time, who actually had very little authority.
And the idea of representing so many people as a congressional member, tell me how that benefits somebody who's wealthier, a large landowner, an aristocrat.
So the baseline from today's perspective, each congressional representative today represents about 700,000 people. So we're talking about vast constituencies. There was nothing like that at the time. In the first Congress, most of the representatives were representing 30 or 40,000 people. But you have to compare that, for example, to a legislator in Massachusetts. A member of the lower house of the Massachusetts legislature represented about 1,400 people. So 1,400 as compared to 30 or 40,000. So you're talking about 20 times as many constituents for each congressional representative as for each member of the Massachusetts lower house. Now, how does that translate into a greater likelihood of the elite being represented? You know, if you're going to be represented from a vast geographic constituency with 40,000 people. And remember, there were very few cities back then. Most of these districts would have been very large geographically because they were sparsely populated. And there was very poor transportation and communication. So how are 30 or 40,000 people going to elect a representative? There aren't that many people in the district who have large reputations. It's going to be somebody who went off and became a hero in the Revolutionary War, like George Washington, or a very large, wealthy landowner who has a large patronage network and lots of people know about and are indebted to that person. So the larger the district, and the people who are supporting the Constitution fully understood this, the larger the district, the more likely you are to get a member of the elite. And in addition, the larger the district and the larger the number of people being represented, the greater the distance, the metaphorical and physical distance that the representative has, which enables the representative to pursue his own vision of the common good rather than simply being a faithful delegate of whatever popular opinion is. And that's what they were looking for. They were looking for elite people who would have a fair amount of discretion to pursue what they saw as the common good rather than just faithfully representing the views of their constituents. And they designed a system that was most more likely to accomplish that.
And you mentioned earlier the indirect election, not just of senators, but also of the president. I imagine that's through the electoral college, which in its original design did not have to necessarily correspond with how a state voted for president.
Right. So we still have the Electoral College system today, but it doesn't operate anywhere like what the framers anticipated. So they were expecting a system that was really twice removed from direct popular election. And they're pretty explicit about the reason. They didn't trust the average American to have informed enough judgments and good enough sense to elect the president of the United States. So the double insulation from direct democracy, the Constitution says that electors will choose the president, and those electors will be selected by a method specified by state legislatures. Now, what many of them were anticipating was that state legislatures would just themselves choose electors rather than turning it over to popular election. The state legislature, for example, in Virginia, would just choose 10 electors because Virginia got 10 of the, actually 12 electors, because Virginia was the largest state. It had 10 representatives, 2 senators, so 12 electors. And those electors then would exercise independent judgment in selecting somebody to be the chief executive of the United States. So it's a double insulation from direct democracy. The people are not choosing, the legislatures are choosing electors who then themselves get together and exercise independent judgment. Now, it hasn't worked out the way that they anticipated. From within the first couple decades of the Republic, it hasn't really worked out the way they anticipated, but they were not expecting the president of the United States to be elected popularly. And of course, as we've seen, both in 2000 and 2016, you can still win the popular vote and not win the Electoral College. That's not a very sensible system in today's world. It's not clear that it was a very sensible system in the world of 1787, but they adopted it because they were having a terrible time figuring out how this powerful chief executive they were creating for the first time under the Constitution ought to be selected. And they managed in the Electoral College system to achieve various different compromises altogether, which enabled them to finally resolve this near impasse that had almost brought the convention to a halt over how to choose the president.
Michael J. Klarman is our guest. Michael J. Klarman is the Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, and he's the author of the book, The Framers' Coup, The Making of the United States Constitution. So again, I think as we're talking about the formation of the legislature, and I think we could look at other aspects, and we will look at other aspects and talk about other aspects of the Constitution that form the government that governs us today, this idea of creating a buffer between those who rule and those and the populist sentiments of their constituency of the day is important. And this is all happening. I mean, we have to keep in mind, as we were talking about earlier, this is with Shays' rebellion in the back of their mind, along with how other states, which they objected to, how other states were giving bringing debt relief and tax relief for people who were in trouble.
Right, right. The background is the framers are horrified by what's going on in the states, and the number one item on their agenda is to make sure that, A, the national government will never be overrun by those sorts of populist demands for relief, and B, they actually write a provision, Article 1, Section 10, that provides the national government that the Constitution forbids states going forward from adopting those sorts of relief measures, and the Constitution creates a federal court system. So if a state decides to pass one of these debtor relief laws going forward, the federal courts are supposed to strike it down.
Yeah. Again, that's Article 1, Section 10 that gives the power to print money to the federal government. That's directly related to what was happening there in the 1880s, in the 1780s.
Right. So the federal government is going to be, it's actually not entirely clear at the founding what exactly the federal government's power is to print paper money. That led to a debate during and after the Civil War. There was a big Supreme Court case about whether the federal government really could print paper money or not. The Constitution's a little ambiguous about that. It's not ambiguous. The states are barred from making anything but gold or silver legal tender. So the states are clearly being deprived of this authority they've been exercising of issuing paper money. It's not entirely clear whether the federal government is being given the authority to print paper money. That had to be resolved by the Supreme Court nearly 100 years later. Hmm. But they want the states out of the business of doing this.
And James Madison, who's really the driver of this constitutional process, getting to the convention, its convention itself, and then basically just wrote the Bill of Rights afterwards himself. He was also the driver of what was called the Virginia Plan. That was sort of a rough draft to work on. There was also a New Jersey plan. There are other plans that came to this convention. But James Madison in his Virginia Plan wanted what was known as the right to veto. In other words, a federal veto, and that the federal government could veto any legislation, any bill, any law that passed from the state legislature.
Right. It's a very radical concept. Even today, the national government does not have any unlimited authority to simply veto a piece of legislation. If the Massachusetts legislature decides to build a bridge over the Charles River, the federal government doesn't have any power to veto that. But under Madison's Virginia plan, Madison's preferred veto would have been absolutely unlimited. He compromised it a little bit in the Virginia plan and limited it to vetoing laws passed by the states that contravened the Articles of Union, the new constitution they were writing. But then somebody else at the convention, Charles Pinckney from South Carolina, proposed an amendment to return to this unlimited veto, and Madison gave a speech in favor of it. This is, again, addressed exactly to this problem of debtor relief and paper money laws. Madison was not convinced that simply having an article in the Constitution saying states shall not pass paper money laws, that states shall not emit paper currency, he just didn't think that was sufficient. He thought creative state legislatures would figure out a way to maneuver around it, and he wanted the national government to have unlimited veto authority over any state legislation. That's an incredibly nationalizing proposal. Even the very nationalist Philadelphia Convention found that going too far. So they substituted for that proposal Article 1, Section 10, which puts limits on the state's ability to issue paper money, limits the ability of states to pass retrospective debt relief. And then they create a federal court system, and they create a supremacy clause that makes it clear that federal law trumps state law to the contrary. That's their substitute for what Madison preferred, which was this unlimited national veto. Now, it's true Madison was the one who came up with the Virginia Plan. It's interesting to note, you know, why was Madison so important? It's not that he was the most eminent of the delegates in Philadelphia. George Washington, Benjamin Franklin were far better known, much older. Madison's pretty young. He's 36 years old. He has a good reputation, but he's only had a few years in the national legislature, a few years in the state legislature. Basically, Madison just worked harder, was better prepared, worked out a systematic critique of the status quo, and came up with proposed remedies for the flaws of the articles and the flaws in the state constitutions. He encouraged his fellow Virginians to show up early in Philadelphia. They coordinated around a plan. Virginia was by far the largest and most important state. They coordinated with the Pennsylvanians. Pennsylvania was the second largest state. And they came up with a plan. And of course, even though they didn't get everything they wanted, they basically formulated the starting agenda of the convention, and where you start influences where you end up. So Madison exercised greater influence over the Constitution, I think it's fair to say, than any other single individual. And then later, the Bill of Rights, which was added a couple of years later, that's almost entirely a product of Madison's efforts. I think it's not going too far to say if it had not been for Madison, there would not have been a Bill of Rights added to the Constitution a couple of years after the Constitution was ratified.
Michael Klarman, you don't really, in your book, say this is good or bad, this distancing of the rulers from the popular will of the people. Now, your book, 600 pages long, I can't say I got through every single page. So if you did somewhere, you'll forgive me on that. But I just saw you saying this is how they did it. And I guess the framers would argue, and my first reading of this is like, wow, man, this is just about aristocrats taking, you know, complete power. But I guess the way the framers would look at this is, hey, you know, we're learning from even, and I believe, that even from the classical world of what happens with mob rule, unchecked factionalism, and that there should be a separation between leaders and the popular will, or even with, you know, during extreme times, the mob.
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, I think while I was working on the book, I found the anti-populism of the framers a little bit distasteful, but mostly because I thought there was a pretty good justification for what the debtor farmers were demanding. The elite tended to regard the debtor farmers as just a bunch of lazy, dissolute, never-do-wells who wanted to redistribute wealth in their direction, but were too lazy to work hard enough to pay their taxes. And I don't think that's probably the best portrait, the most accurate portrait of the debtor farmers. I think basically they felt as if they were being screwed over by a contracting economy and an effort simultaneously to raise taxes and insist on the payment in hard currency, which largely didn't exist at the time. So if you have a more sympathetic view of the substantive legislation that the debtor farmers were pursuing, then I think you're going to have a less attractive view of the framers' anti-populism. I confess that as we got closer to the 2016 election, which is roughly when the book came out, and you see what's going on in the rest of the world, you know, populist movements taking England out of the European Union or electing right-wing authoritarians in countries like Hungary and Poland, you know, populism may start to look a little bit less attractive. And again, you start to see the wisdom of the framers in thinking maybe there ought to be some distance between government and the mob. But I think at the end of the day, probably what you think about populism and anti-populism is heavily influenced by the substantive policies that are being debated. And if take an example, in Switzerland, they had a referendum 10 years ago on whether to allow minarets. So here's an incredibly populist solution. We're going to have a referendum on whether to ban minarets because the people of Switzerland were worried about an increasing Muslim population, and it passed. It passed by like 55 to 60%. So that is extreme populism, government by referendum, and what I think most of us ought to see is a very unattractive result, because now the Swiss Constitution says freedom of religion shall be protected, but you are forbidden from building a minaret, which sounds like a contradiction.
And that wouldn't happen here. That wouldn't happen here under our Constitution, unless we made a constitutional amendment, which is a huge process in of itself.
Yeah, so I'm actually not sure about that, right? I don't know if it is possible for authoritarian-minded leaders who can exploit fear of the other to lead people to very unattractive positions. So, just go back 10 or 15 years, a majority of states passed constitutional amendments through referenda barring gay marriage. And today, 65% of the country thinks gay marriage is a good thing. But if you just go back to 2004, only a third of the country thought it was a good thing. And in state after state, Republican politicians put it on the ballot because they realized it would be a very productive way to mobilize their base and maybe influence swing voters in their direction. So, you know, populism can produce good results and it can produce bad results. And maybe at the end of the day, we evaluate populism based on the substantive outcomes that it produces. And in today's world, some of those results are pretty scary. Now, the framers thought that about debt relief and tax relief, but I think they actually had a kind of unjustified elite disdain for average hardworking farmers who are being crushed by debt and taxes at a time that any modern economist would tell you we ought to be loosening fiscal and monetary policy, but the states were doing the opposite because they were trying to pay off their war debt.
How did slavery play in to the creation of the Constitution?
Slavery is a big deal. I've devoted an entire chapter to slavery, but it's important to try to understand exactly what sense it was a big deal. There was never any significant effort to suppress slavery in the Constitution. That would have been a non-starter. There were people in Philadelphia who had severe distaste for slavery. People like Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin, were at the forefront of trying to end slavery in their own states. That would be respectively New York for Hamilton and Pennsylvania for Franklin. But it would be a non-starter to provide in the Constitution that slavery is forbidden. And I think that's true for three reasons. First of all, the southern states were utterly dependent on slavery, both as a economic and a social system. So 40% of the South's population was enslaved. In South Carolina, 50 to 60% of the population's enslaved. The wealthiest people in the country are Eastern South Carolina rice planters. And there's just no chance they're going to give up this system, which is both critical to their economic livelihood and to their sense of what a good social system is. So you're not going to have a union between North and South if the North insists on ending slavery. Second point is, even Northerners who have distaste for slavery tend to be fairly racist by modern standards, and they're not looking to liberate the black population and turn them into citizens, especially in a state like South Carolina, where, as I've said, more than 50% of the population is enslaved. They can't really imagine a world in which those people are free and treated as equal citizens. And then finally, the last factor is everybody in Philadelphia believes deeply in the sanctity of property rights. So they wouldn't think you can just engage in wholesale confiscation of slave property. They would think you would have to compensate for that. And that would have been a vast amount of money, which the federal government never could conceivably have undertaken. Even in northern states where the slave population was relatively small, you know, in Pennsylvania, it's a few percent. The largest would be, you know, a state like New York or New Jersey, where it might be 8 to 10%. Even in those states, slave owners exercised enough political clout that they were able to resist emancipation in New York and New Jersey for several years after the Constitution was adopted. And when those states did emancipate slaves, they did it with a form of compensation. Basically, they adopted laws that said nobody currently alive will be freed, but only children born to slaves from this day going forward will be freed when they reach the age, for example, of 28, which was a way of compensating owners for the emancipation of their slaves.
As we move to wrap up, again, the title of your book is The Framers' Coup, and you've indicated one rationale for calling it The Framers' Coup earlier. I also thought of a coup connection with just the way that the convention and the Constitution itself was approved. Again, this was under the auspices of the Articles of Confederation. And the idea was to amend the Articles of Confederation and to change them, to make them stronger, to make the central government stronger, but not to undo it. And with the Articles of Confederation, to make major changes to them, you needed all 13 states to sign off on them. The Constitution, you only needed 9 states to ratify it, not all 13. So for me, that in itself, the way they did that switch from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution that we now recognize, very much seems like a coup in of itself.
Yeah, it's a great point. It was one of the things I was fascinated by while I was working on the project. I didn't really appreciate until I got into the details exactly how extraordinary was the accomplishment of what they managed to execute. So in the title, I'm thinking of it mostly as a coup against public opinion, because I don't think the American people necessarily approved of a vast amount of what was in the Constitution. But you're exactly right. It is a coup against the Articles of Confederation in several different ways. So the Articles of Confederation don't provide for a constitutional convention. If you want to amend the Articles, it's expressly provided how you do that. Congress passes an amendment, then it goes before the states. As you say, it has to be unanimously ratified. It has to be ratified by state legislatures. And in Philadelphia, they just changed the rules, and basically they were trying to see if they could get away with it. So Article 7 of the Constitution provides that the Constitution will go into effect once 9 states approve it, And it's not the state legislatures. It's a special convention of the people that will be called by the legislature. So you've moved from unanimity to nine states putting this into operation, although conceitedly those nine states can only bind themselves. No state can bind any other. And it's not the legislatures. The legislatures have the most to lose from the Constitution because they're being deprived of their power. The delegates decide to circumvent the legislatures and have special conventions of the people who might have less of a vested interest in preserving the articles. And they just made it up. You know, when they went to Philadelphia, everybody assumed that anything proposed by the convention would have to go to Congress for its approval and then be submitted to the states for unanimous approval. And they just changed the rules and decided to see if they could get away with it. And they did. It's really kind of extraordinary what they pulled off. I think, you know, I tried to explain this. It's not a lot of evidence for this, but I think basically once they had written the Constitution and Congress had agreed to pass it on to the states, it became very difficult for a state legislature to explain why they would refuse to call a ratifying convention of the people to pronounce a verdict on the Constitution, right? How could a state legislator run for re-election saying, I distrust the people and therefore I oppose submitting the Constitution to a popular verdict in a popularly elected ratifying convention? And I think that's why the state legislatures decided to call the conventions, because the Philadelphia Convention had no way of forcing state legislatures to do anything. But in the end, every state legislature except Rhode Island's, which held out for several years, every other state legislature acquiesced to calling a convention. And then once nine states ratified, it was almost impossible for the remaining four to stay out of the union, because they would be treated as foreign nations, they would be deprived of military protection, and they would be subjected to trade discrimination like a foreign nation. So once nine states ratified, it was pretty much a foregone conclusion that the other four would have no choice but to come along.
Michael J. Clareman is the Kirkland and Ellis Professor of Law at Harvard Law School, and he is the author of the book, The Framers' Coup, The Making of the United States Constitution. Michael Clareman, I enjoyed our conversation very much, found it very interesting, and I thank you greatly for spending time with us today.
I enjoyed it too. Thanks very much for having me.